accession number 10081, Reel 3.
You about your experience in Troneswood. And first of all, I wonder, you know, could you give me some idea of what we talk about Troneswood, what it would have been like when you actually went in at this stage in the Somme's bottom? Now, was there much of a wood there? Were there many trees?
Yes, the trees. There was quite a lot of trees, and you could hear the shells coming through the trees. There was no trench system like they usually started off with, but it was just a dense wood, and the shells were cracking against the trees, you see, and our chaps were in and out of the trees.
Did it make for many problems, you know? I've noticed with the aftermath of this hurricane, the state of the woods and the tangled branches. And splinters.
Well, there were branches coming down all the time and tripping up, and you had to keep in touch with the man next to you. But it was really a kind of a form of open warfare. You see, we'd gone away from the trench system. It was almost open warfare then, because we were advancing very, very slowly, a few yards at a time. That was the Somme. That was the sad part about it. Heavy casualties and not gaining much ground.
Yes, as you have explained to me before.
Yes.
But I was wondering, you know, in this
and
situation...
We were mobile, you see.
Yes.
Headquarters were always on the move. The forward troops were all going forward, edging forward by degrees, a yard or so at a time. And you never know what you're going to miss... come across, you see.
Mm. Well, what was your objective in that wood? Did you have to drive the Germans out?
Yes. Ferret them out of their nests, because they had concealed machine guns, you see. And we had men in front who had been trained as bombers, and they would go forward, fiddle out, you know, get to know these nests and bomb them as much as possible. And then, of course, then after that, then the artillery would come down, you see, and that kind of thing.
And you yourself as a signaller, what were you doing in
the was with the battalion headquarters, maintaining communication with brigade at the back, and then division, trying to maintain communication with the rear part of the line. But everything was mobile just then, you see. There wasn't a steady line at all.
I was wondering, really, you know, would it have been very difficult communications in that situation?
Yes, because as the shell fire came, trees were falling down. It was almost impossible. If you run a line out on your reel, the next thing you knew, it had been hit by a shell, had to send a linesman out to repair it, and very often it was difficult to try and find a broken line in a wood. It was frightful. I think we tried visual, but there wasn't enough vacant space for the chap to receive the signal. But we relied as much as possible on telephones. So then we advanced. Now we weren't there, we were not there very long. We were withdrawn for some reason.
Yes, but before you tell me about that, you know, the German machine gunners.
Yes.
Did they put up quite a resistance?
You could always hear the rat tat of the machine gun somewhere.
What were their guns like compared with ours, do you think?
I believe they were rather... I'm not a gunner, but I think they were rather heavier calibre. And I think our people had just the ordinary, you know, a lighter gun, I think. But the Germans, I think just then, I think they hadn't formed the British Machine Gun Corps. That was really the beginning of the, I think so, about that time. Then, of course, when we first came to France, each battalion only had two silly little Lewis guns, which were ridiculous. Germany had those machine guns well before us, and they could fire overhead firing at machine guns. They needn't fire you in front. If they knew there was a certain path from aerial photographs which they could take, they would train a machine gun on that path in the hope of catching ration parties or reinforcements coming up. There's a lot of overhead firing towards the end of the war, machine guns. We used to hear them whizzing through the air, you know. They didn't realise they were dangerous. And then that was Trones Wood. And now that period, you know, gradually we were relieved.
Who were you relieved by?
I don't know. It was a British regiment. But then we came on. We're coming on now towards August, September. We're coming now to Fleurs, aren't we? Yes. And that's when the first tanks came on the scene.
And did you see the first tanks?
Oh, yes, I saw the... Well, as I described this, I saw this soldier. I thought he was kneeling down, attending to the tank, and the chap was dead because rigor mortis had set in, and he just died like that. But there were cumbersome things. They were stuck in the mud. They couldn't move. But I think they frightened the life out of Jerry when he first saw them.
Did you actually see them moving yourself?
Oh, yes, yes. Very, very slowly. They were not fast, you know.
So how would that pace have related to men, the infantry men?
About the same, I should think, at that time. Mind, I think they got faster tanks later on in the war. Probably lighter tanks, but they were very cumbersome things at first. Terrific caterpillar wheels, you know, and what they were very good, of course, that they were able to get across the trench, you see, without and they'd crush the wires, you see. They did work that the artillery couldn't do. Very often our men attacked the German front line and found the wire hadn't been cut by our own artillery, but as soon as the tanks came along, of course, they simply crushed the wires, you see. And even his machine guns, you see, because the infantry used to follow just behind the tank. There may be 6 or 12 men. I don't know what the tactics were in those days, but there was usually a little party of infantrymen following the tank. And but it was the state of the ground, you see. Of course, mud gets in those caterpillar wheels, you know. They're very hard to go. Then we finished that stage, we came out relieved.
Yes.
And then back again, still yes. On the Somme, and then came a slight rest. Of course, there were no billets, you see. What we used to do is we used to get these large ammunition boxes and try and make a house to keep the rain out, just to give the men perhaps a night's rest. See, there were no houses there. It was open country, just terrific woods. And then, of course, then we came onto Fleurs. That was in September, October, I think, really. And then, of course, it was open country again, but no forests, no trees. It was all open country. And we had a frightful time. It was very difficult getting the rations up, and we were short of water. You see, you can exist without food, but you can't exist without water. And the men were crying out for water.
And how long do you think you went without, you know, water at a stretch?
Oh, several days. And there's no hot food coming up. It was very, very difficult.
Yes, so what did you do for water in the end? You know,
They bring these jerry can things, you know, water and that, but it was a question of getting them up on the backs of mules or something like that. The artillery, you see, were in the open, the guns were in the open. The Australian battery there, we used to watch them being the ammunition coming up. They put the shells on the side of the mules. They couldn't bring the ammunition wagons up because the ground was too soft. These mules used to have the shells on each side of the mule, perhaps two or three mules together with one driver, dash across to the battery, unload the shells quickly, dash back. And all the time, at Fleurs, he was watching them. He had a balloon, you see, and he used to try and put a shell behind them and one in front and chase them coming. We used to watch them, you know, doing this, you know. Those drivers were marvellous. It was like the Epsom races, you know, going across there. But those mules were very good. But I don't know what it was with the British Army, but we always seemed to be under observation from Germany. I think their engineers were good at sighting a place where to stop. I remember when we finally got away from Ypres up north, and I had to look back to the town of Ypres down below. He said he must have seen every movement. Of course, it was a salient, you know, Ypres. You couldn't move in the daytime. No, there's no movement in the daytime. But anyhow, we got to Fleurs, and we then I had a slight touch of dysentery, but we had the famous Army Number 9, which was supposed to cure everything, and I was all right next day. I went on the doctor's parade next day, but it was with having the hot food, not having a hot food, and then suddenly having this hot food behind with a rum ration, you see, which upset the tummies, I suppose. And talk about the Russians, if you could have seen our chaps hadn't shaved, you see. We thought we just looked like Russian soldiers. Some had beards down and everything.
You'd been there, of course, since July, hadn't you? July until October.
Yes, yes.
In the Somme area.
Yes, yes.
Was it a great relief for you when you got out, you know, in October?
Yes,
Can you remember how you felt?
Yes, yes. They shunted us down to Valery-sur-Mer on the coast. And now we thought, now we're going to have a jolly good time now. Of course, we were filthy, you know. Mud, boots, everything. And of course, the order came clean. Everything had to be cleaned up. You're going to have a nice rest. But of course, it was only a story. Because they rushed us after two or three days up to the town of Bayeul. That's the north of the line. When we got to Bayeul, it was in flames. Because he was attacking there. He'd left the Somme, he was attacking on the north now. And we went to this little village, and I know I had the signal station in a doctor's house. And I was extremely lucky because there was wine all round the walls.
Yes. If I could keep to your experience of the Somme area for this period,
yes.
Did you have any idea of how the losses were during the Somme battle? You know, you as your job as signaller.
No.
Did you know how many you had lost in the battalion?
Well, you see, signals every day, each battalion in the front had to send back to the rear the ration strength, which showed figures each day that how many had lost the day before. They had to have the ration strength so as the transport behind could bring your rations up when it got dark. So each battalion knew how many people they'd lost. But we had no idea the losses of the whole battle. Well, we had too much to do. We had too much looking after ourselves and keeping down as much as possible. We never knew the progress of any battle, how it was going, except of the loss of our own friends. Then we knew there was something silly there.
Did you lose many of your pals?
Yes, I lost quite a lot, yes. Mm.
Did it depress you, losing your friends? I wonder, as a young lad, you stood up.
Mustn't forget, I was very young. See, I was only 19 or 20. And you don't think of things like that, you know. Every day, you've got so much to do, and you're so tired after the work, that you sometimes you lie down and go fast asleep. You're so tired. But before you knew where you were, there was a call to get ready to go up the line again. As I say now, when we got back after the Somme to St. Valery on the coast, we thought we were going to have at least a week or 2 weeks rest. But we shunted up to Bayeul, to stem the German onslaught there.
Yes.
So there's no rest, you see.
No. The other thing I was going to ask you, about your time in the Somme area.
Yes.
Did you come across many dead bodies, lying about?
Yes. There were here and there. There were dead bodies because they hadn't time to move the bodies away. I believe I did read that. I think they had a special corps for that kind of thing. I believe. Yes. Well, I remember. This was Fleurs. We came out of Fleurs, and we were coming out by compass, because there was any distinguishing marks of the country. And we came to this disused trench. And my pal said to me, he said, "Gosh, it's very soft. What are we treading on?" And he said, "Well, don't you know?" I said, "No. Well, it's a trench full of dead Germans." See, there may some of our fellows been there as well, but they just put them in the trench. But it's just a terrible sight to see. They're generally all black, they go black, And I remember one case we had a chap who went get off his rocker. But I'm going back a bit now. On Fleurs, we found that this trench was full of dead Germans. Mm.
Could you tell me about the chap who went off his rocker?
Yes, well, he was a fellow signaller too. He was in the front line, and he suddenly got up one night, jumped out of the trench, and he saw this dead German. And of course, they get supernatural strength when they're like that, And he wasn't a very strong chap, and he was picking this German up and throwing it back into the trench. Well, the colonel heard about this and sent a squad forward. He said, "Put the man in a waist, a jacket. Sit on him and do something to stop him from moving." I think they got him down to the line afterwards. He'd just gone off his rocker.
Was there heavy shelling?
Heavy shelling,
at the time?
Yes. There's always shelling. You're always like this. You always hunch like this, Naturally, you all go down. But,
can you remember the shells, the different types of shells that the Germans sent over during the Somme area?
The ones I dreaded was the five, what they call the 5.9s. And, people used to call them coal boxes. They were a terrific shell. And used to whiz, it was over like anything. But he had heavier shells as well when he was sending them at the back areas. He'd use a heavier shell. But none of us liked the 5.9s in the front line. And then, of course, afterwards, he had these what they call trench mortars. They used to be fired from the front line and whiz over onto his front line. They were wicked things. And of course, he had the same thing. As soon as we had a trench mortar stunt on his line, in about a short time afterwards he would reply with the same thing, simply knocking the front line about to do anything really. But each day you didn't realise how time was going, except the weather conditions. You could see the weather gradually deteriorating, because Haig, he had to stop in the end because of the weather. He'd have liked to have gone on.
Yes. What did you yourself think, while you were at the Somme? Did you feel that you had achieved anything at the end of your period, that it was worthwhile, this battle? Can you remember how you felt at
no,
the time?
We used to swear.
Did you?
Yes. We took every day as it came. And, I may say no one... The information it was very scarce, I think in the Second World War, I believe that the troops were shown plans and everything, and how things were going. Montgomery did that, but nobody knew. you very seldom saw a staff officer there. Very seldom. But in a battle, there's so much to do, and so apprehensive of things that might happen, that you're all the time on the qui vive, you know. And then you're so tired at the end of the day that you just lie down and fall asleep. So when I look back and I think the kind of I've slept on concrete in a pillbox, slept on a barn in a French barn, and heard the rats underneath in the straw. You used to take the rations and everything from it. But that was the song. The song gradually, you know, filtered out. You know, he couldn't get any further with that. They couldn't. Yes. I don't think they didn't get as far as St. Quentin, as far as I know, and that's where we stopped.
Yes. Other thing, you mentioned seeing the tanks at
Yes, Pairs. Yes, of course. Yes.
Did you ever see the cavalry at Somme? Was there any evidence of the cavalry at all?
Cavalry were there. Our division was the 30th. We were the right, extreme right of the British line. And the cavalry were there, waiting. And I believe we were one of the few divisions that reached their objectives on that first day. And I believe, I don't know, that the people who were in charge said, well, could we go forward? Because we were through. He was running back. And the cavalry were waiting at the side. But no, they were afraid. They were afraid of being, on the flank. They're afraid because the people on our left were held up, and they were held up by machine guns. So they were afraid of letting the cavalry loose, because the flank would have been, you know, deserted. But we were one of the few divisions that reached our objectives, and it was only the division on the left that was held up with machine guns. But the cavalry were there, yes.
Did you also get any idea of the medical attention for men during the Somme battle? You know, was there evidence of...
Well, you had your battalion medical officer, and you always had... There were stretcher bearers. They were the men who bore the brunt, because they were used to rescue them from the actual front line and get them back to the... casualty station at the back, a first aid post, you see. Then from the first aid post you move to what they call, I think, a central clearing station. That's before they got to the big hospitals, so you went back in stages. But it was a terrible job trying to manoeuvre a stretcher down a trench sometimes, if the trench was very narrow. Sometimes they had to lift up these stretchers, you know. You were lucky. No, the stretcher bearers had the main... They were the first to come on the scene. And they were just ordinary infantrymen who'd had medical training. They were not the proper RAMC, which... RAMC were in the back of with the big field hospitals. And that was another thing, too. They always put a field hospital in the middle of where there's a big gun. There was one place we were in, the field, we came out for rest. Big field hospital, because it was all big marquees, you know, no buildings. And there was they used to bring this gun up at night on the railway. Fire a few shots and go back. And of course, old Jerry would retaliate, and very often he would hit the hospital. I can't understand why they used to put these hospitals right close to where the guns were. I don't know why they did it. So a lot of funny things went on in those days.
At the end of the Somme battle, you know, your battalion, did it change at all, the composition?
The Somme altered... I should think the Somme altered the whole British Army. I think... it was never the same again. Of course, we lost over 500 men It was never the same again. Reinforcements came in, and they could be anybody. They could be part of a Scottish regiment. We had a towards the end Northumberland Cyclist Battalion, which had made them into infantry. So we got, there were good chaps still there that given the bicycles up, and they became infantry. Then we had the Lancashire Hussars. You see, they were cavalry. Then they made them into infantry. So the battalion, after the 1st of July, the battalion never changed. It was never the same again. Never, never, no. Because very often, if they went back to England wounded, they didn't always come back to your own battalion. They could send them anywhere. Because the big base was ETAPS, you know, where they had these riots and that. But and they used to say, well, send you anywhere where you were wanted.
Yes. Did this mean, you know, the fact that it changed like that, did it lose its sort of,
yeah,
the nature of
esprit de corps.
De corps, did it?
The family, see, the PALS battalions were, the idea was to keep officers and men in the same district, and they knew each other. We all knew our officers, except perhaps the colonel. He was came in from some guards regiment, so they were, but all our officers, we all knew in everyday civilian life, because we were all civilians, you see. We used to call them Jack and Bill sometimes, you know, we're not supposed to do that, but we did. But the whole thing changed after the Somme changed the whole thing, to my opinion. It was never the same again, never, never. I lost a lot of good friends there. Liverpool and Manchester especially had a very, very bad time, because we had the Liverpool PALS, four battalions, and I think two or three battalions for the Manchester PALS. We were usually together. Then they brought in regular battalions to stiffen up us, but our chaps knew more about them than they did, really.
Yes. Do you remember the air activity on the Somme? You know, you've mentioned about the balloon observing,
yes. Oh, yes.
What was going on. Was, yes, there much evidence of air activity on either side?
We could see. We used to watch dogfights in the air. You know, we could see the planes firing at each other. I didn't see. The only chap I saw come down was when on the Battle of Arras. I went over the plane, but we couldn't stop. I don't know what happened. He was dead, the chap. He was a pilot. He'd been flown down. But yes, there were dogfights. And then balloons, you know, sometimes the plane would attack a balloon with them, you know, and you see the going flame, the poor chap. I don't think some of them hadn't parachutes, did they, at first? No. Afterwards, of course, they had parachutes, but they were. Used to float down to the ground. But I don't think they were the battles that were in the Second World War, but there were battles going on, because we could hear the firing, you know, that kind of thing.